Welcome to Global Issues with Vic Plesner, the show that covers worldwide issues for all walks of life. Here to provide you with information on your world is writer, lecturer, and host of Global Issues, Vic Plesner.
Welcome to Global Issues. I'm your host, Vic Plesner. A special thanks to members of the American Correctional Association, members of corrections at yahoogroups.com, and members of the National Major Gang Task Force. I also want to thank a couple of groups that I belong to locally here in Thailand. One is called Networking for Success. They're located in Bangkok, and the Excel Results Foundation. If you belong to an organization and want to be mentioned on our show, drop me a line at globalissues@radiobangkok.net. Also, if you have written a book and would like me to review it and put it on our website, have your publisher or yourself send me a copy. After I have reviewed it, I will consider inviting you to be a guest on the show. Our special guest today is Kay Picard. Dr. Carolyn Joan Kay Picard, she likes to be called Kay, is currently an associate professor of English and courtesy associate professor of law at Florida State University. She is a philosopher and former molecular embryologist educated in the Philippines and the United States. She has a PhD with honors. Her academic accomplishments are so numerous, I honestly can't go through the whole thing without tying up 90% of our show. She has published articles in film criticism, criminology, law, social and political philosophy, aesthetics, feminism and philosophy, as well as more than 80 popular pieces on Philippine art and culture as a columnist in various Korean and U.S. newspapers and magazines. Now, for another side of her, she was trained in ballet, Hawaiian dance, and Philippine folk dance for 15 years and has been a student of ballroom since 1990. She developed a radio program, Ballroom Dancing with a Twist, which is currently being streamed over the internet. Her most recent dance-related accomplishments are winning second place in the Millennium Dance Sport Nationals in Pro-Am Cabaret Dancing in 2005 and capturing second place in the U.S. Open in the World's Pro-Am Cabaret Competition also in 2005, where 40 countries participated and the very best in the world competed. She is also a visual artist who has exhibited in the Philippines, South Korea, and various parts of the U.S., and has started an art business called Kinesthetics, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Kay, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you, Vic. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks. You know, I know, Kay, that you've been doing a lot of interviews lately, and I really appreciate your squeezing us into your schedule. I know it must be very hectic for you.
Oh, certainly. It's no trouble at all. And I've heard a lot of very good things about you and your show, so of course I couldn't say no.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. How much of your time is spent as an associate professor at Florida State University?
Okay, officially I teach twice a week. That doesn't sound like a lot, Tuesdays and Thursdays, but really I'm very busy on those days. And I teach back to back to back, and then I really don't get off until close to 10 p.m. at night because of the workload. And then the rest of the time I'm supposed to be writing my books as well as doing a lot of service. This year, for example, I'm co-organizing FSU's annual film and literature conference on, interestingly enough, Documenting Trauma, Documenting Terror. So it's on the documentary form in relation to the Holocaust and other traumatic events like 9/11, for example. It's very apropos.
Wow. Now, in reviewing your biography, it appears that most of your time is spent writing books and dancing. Is this correct, or am I leaving a lot of other things out?
Well, you've mentioned quite a bit of it. I must say your introduction was one of the most concise introductions I've ever heard. Okay, I do art as well, as you know, and have several gallery exhibitions typically going on at the same time. And I try to couple these with dance demonstrations because it becomes so much more easy for the audience to relate to the art and to me. It breaks the ice. I also choreograph and train with the Tallahassee Community College Dance Company in ballroom. I do a lot of benefits pro bono. I'm quite active with the Rotary and Lions Club. And then when I'm in training for competition, of course, I travel a lot to work with my partner. That's pretty much it.
Well, that's a lot. And without repeating everything, which I was going to do, but we've sort of said a lot of it in the bio, and you've just covered some of it also. You seem to have an endless wealth of knowledge. How do you do it?
I guess the key is being passionate about everything I do. I also happen to like keeping busy, so I suspect all the energy and the enthusiasm really comes from that genuine love of what I am lucky enough to be doing.
Let's talk a little bit about your work with horror movies. Why would anybody actually volunteer to sit 2 hours through 2 hours of torture, pain, fear, horror, and something that might give them nightmare for weeks and pay for it besides?
That is a peculiar pleasure, if you want to talk about it that way. But as we know, horror films have many forms, and I think there are different ways that we react to them. There is, of course, classic horror with Frankenstein, you know, the 30s and 40s variety, maybe even the 60s variety. And then you have science fiction horror, which is much more contemporary and a hybrid form. Then you have horror comedies, of course, which have a certain lightness that is not characteristic of classic horror. You have slasher flicks, which for me are very difficult to watch. And then you have psychological thrillers like Psycho, which have a very different way of making you interact with the horrifying. And then you have serial killer films, which are much more in vogue these days. So they all have very different appeals, but they do, I think part of the appeal is that they reflect back to us our anxieties as a collective, but they also reflect back to us some of our fantasies. So they capture, if you wish, the cultural milieu and the interests at the moment, and they show it back to us in an imaginative landscape, and I think that's part of the appeal.
When I was preparing for this show, I was thinking to myself, you know, I really don't like to watch horror movies. Mm-hmm. I guess they still scare me at my age. But, although I'm looking at your book here, Remaking the Frankenstein Myth on Film, Between Laughter and Horror, which I'm in the process of reading and reviewing. And I actually can relate to Frankenstein. He's kind of like a nice guy.
Yes. Because the monster is more like an alienated child that's been neglected and abused. And so that's why you understand why, because he's been ostracized so much and physically violently assaulted, why he hits back. All he wants really is a mate, someone to love him.
I think I just opened myself up for psychoanalysis.
Well, it's not just you that relates to the creature. In fact, Mary Shelley saw the creature as the one, the character with her voice. So there are a lot of biographical convergences between Mary Shelley's own childhood, her detached relationship with her father, the fact that she was orphaned by her mother, and so on and so forth. So, you know, you're not the only one who can relate to the creature. I do too, actually.
Okay, I'm going to take a small break here. And when we come back, I'm going to ask you about are there real monsters in the world? This is Vic Plessner on Global Issues. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back with your host, Vic Plessner, and his guest, Kay Picard. If you want a chance to win a copy of Kay Picard's book, Remaking the Frankenstein Myth on Film, Between Laughter and Horror, go to radiobangkok.net/GI for Global Issues. Complete the 5 checkoff questions, and we'll enter your name into the hat and select a winner. That's radiobangkok.net/GI. We hope you are enjoying this show of Global Issues with your host, Vic Plessner. If you would like to be a sponsor or guest of Global Issues, please contact us at globalissues.radiobangkok.net. That's globalissues.radiobangkok.net. Hot in the city.
Welcome back to Global Issues. Kay, before we broke, I mentioned that I wanted to ask you, are there real monsters in the world?
Okay. And I believe that part of that question was aligned with the question, do monster movies come first, or do real monsters actually pre-exist their depictions in movies? In some ways, it's like the chicken-egg question, you know, which came first, since they tend to cycle back and forth. Keep in mind that films, for me, really are an imaginative and commercialized expression of what interests us, what fascinates us, what wounds us. And if you want to use a little bit of philosophy, you could use Hegelian dialectic to talk about this. In other words, there's a connection between reality, fact, if you wish, and fiction. Using Hegel's language, if you wish, there is a thesis or a first term. Let us perhaps call that a fictional term. It doesn't have to be the first one. But you have a monster movie like a vampire. And then you have the antithesis, the second term, the seeming opposite, because it's fact, like a real serial killer, like Ed Gein, for example, or Ted Bundy, who's a real monster. And then from the interaction between the two terms, you have a third term, which is the synthesis. And there's a new mythic monster that arises, like Hannibal Lecter. And interestingly enough, because of Hannibal Lecter's popularity, the FBI actually created a new division for serial killers. So it actually generated concrete public policy. So there is an interaction between the two. Part of the complexity of the question, though, is the term monster, because it comes loaded with so many things, so much baggage. But if you look at the etymology or the genesis of the term, it comes from two root words, monere, meaning to warn or to warn against, and monstrare, meaning to point to or to demonstrate. So when you call someone a monster, something monstrous, what you're doing is you're pointing it out, you're drawing attention to it, and you're saying, be careful of that, because that's not normal behavior. So in that sense, it really is not as heavily laden as one would contextually think, the way it's used popularly anyway.
Does the news media create today's monsters? For example, I guess I can relate, in having come from New Jersey, they've mm-hmm. made sex crimes really a monstrous act today.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I think the news media over-sensationalizes it to the
right.
point of making them into monsters, where normally 10 or 20 years ago we would have just passed it off as another crime.
Yes, indeed. That's an interesting question, as it gets at this connection between rhetoric, that is the art of persuasion, which the media is laden with and paid to do, and reality. Can overheated rhetoric create an oversimplified count? Yes, certainly all the time. Yet monster talk, if you wish, also serves in some ways an important civic function. As Edward Ingebretson, he's one of my friends, points out, monsters mythically and politically serve as fallen angels. They're the converse of good citizens. So there is a function for monster talk. The problem is that it's oversimplified a lot of times. And the minute you use the term monster, it shuts off a lot of discourse.
Hmm. Now, when I think of Frankenstein, for example, I guess he's the common monster in the movies. I can't associate him to like a Hitler or Stalin or Pol Pot. But
yes.
Is there a relationship?
Well, there are different types of monsters, of course. Hitler, Stalin, and Pol Pot, I would probably compare more to vampires, with their ability to mesmerize their publics, you know, with their rhetorical manipulations, and to feed ruthlessly on others with their cunning. So the Frankenstein monster is very different, as we talked about earlier, because of their alienated status, and therefore they tend to be more feminized, if you wish, despite their, you know, the monster's bulk and violence and power. He's still more feminized relative to, for example, male vampires. So to take a typical example, Eileen Wuornos, who's supposed to be the first female serial killer in the U.S., in Monster, the movie, was depicted more like a Frankenstein and monster, because she's, you know, a lonely outcast in search of love. The way she lumbers about, you know, with her sort of ugliness, is more comparable to the Frankenstein and monster than to a vampire. And it's interesting that male serial killers are made to look more like vampires, male vampires.
Hmm.
So there is a qualitative difference between which type of monster you're talking about.
And is that because they don't want to associate them as being feminine?
Yes. Any threat to masculinity
yeah.
has to be held at bay.
I was just thinking, because I have a security consulting background, of one of the tactics when you're dealing with people like Pablo Escobar or terrorists and so forth, is to incite them to the point where they just become erratic and come out in the open and then do stupid things, and hopefully you can capture them. And I was just mm-hmm. thinking that a good tactic would be to take some of these people like Osama bin Laden and start referring to them as being feminist.
Feminist or feminine?
Feminine, yeah. Feminine, I'm sorry.
Yes, feminine, yes. Yeah. Certainly, any slur on masculinity is a weapon, right?
Yeah, that would drive them nuts. Okay, I'm sorry. I get carried away.
Not at all.
President Bush referred to Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein as monsters. Is his wording correct?
Well, I would say, again, it's an example of oversimplified and overheated rhetoric. Certainly there is a lot that could be called evil, if you wish, that is attributable to their actions. But let me take a bit of a digression in order to get to the main point. I recall a book by Jessica Stern. I don't know if you've read it. It's a New York Times notable book titled In the Name of God, and I would highly recommend it. The subtitle is Why Religious Militants Kill, in which, based on her extensive field trips and autoethnographic experiences, Stern arrives at the conclusion that it is entirely possible to empathize, take note, not sympathize, but empathize, with a criminal or terrorist mindset. So to see them still as human and as psychologically not really rational, but understandable to some extent, but not to condone it. The problem is, for me, Bush's rhetoric tends to be too fast and a little too easy sometimes. It's a form of moralism masquerading as reasoned and nationalistic public policy. Now, there is good reason for it to become particularly compelling at this point in time, because the threat is real. But it becomes too much of a shorthand for really very complex issues dealing with power.
Is it preconceived on his part intentionally to do this, to oversimplify it, you think?
I think to galvanize public policy and to make it easy to have a lot of support for very aggressive military tactics, which normally would have, you know, a system of checks and balances in place in order to make sure that the policies are well thought out from various political angles. But, you know, the argument that there is an urgency, therefore we really can't afford to, you know, take our time about this, tends to shortcut a lot of things, leading to abuses like the Abu Ghraib scandal, for example.
Sure. Okay, Kay, we're going to take another break. We'll be right back. This is Vic Plesner, your host on Global Issues.
We'll be right back with your host, Vic Plesner, and his guest, Kay Picard. If you want a chance to win a copy of Kay Picard's book, Remaking the Frankenstein Myth on Film, Between Laughter and Horror, go to radiobangkok.net/GI for Global Issues. Complete the 5 checkoff questions, and we'll enter your name into the hat and select a winner. That's radiobangkok.net/GI. We hope you are enjoying this show of Global Issues with your host, Vic Plesner. If you would like to be a sponsor or guest of Global Issues, please contact us at globalissues.radiobangkok.net. That's globalissues.radiobangkok.net. Hot in the city.
Welcome back to Global Issues. Kay, I just want to read a piece that I recently read, and please correct anything that is not exactly the way it's supposed to be quoted. And starting quotes, I've started looking at the face of the monster in relation to horror themes in film, Picard explains, and how journalistic and documentary motives exploit human suffering in order to fulfill some sort of entertainment value and convince people of certain truths by blurring fact and fiction. So I guess what I want to ask you is, how is truth and being distorted, and what's the method to convince people of the questionable monster association?
Okay, let me try to answer that very complicated question through a set of counter questions so you see where I'm coming from.
Okay.
And the main question I'd like to ask is, can truth in itself be separated from the way in which truth is analyzed, examined, explored, and presented? What is truth devoid of rhetorical framing and political context? And yet, you know, because that sounds so relativist, like anything goes, it depends on how the spin is given. That's not what I'm heading towards. And yet there is such a thing as truth, right? It's just more complicated than we think it is. So maybe the best way of getting at this for me is to go to a philosopher called Thomas Kuhn, who's a philosopher of science, and he came up with the term paradigms. And he says what really constitutes the core of a paradigm is that people are able to verify, to intersubjectively verify claims. So there's a certain verificatory purpose to the issues being discussed, but also they lead to further questions and further answers. So is the paradigm fruitful? So the way of answering your question, therefore, is that yes, there are such things as monsters. There are things as evil things done by people in ways that can be understood. Now, we may not agree with why they do things, but we can understand them if we choose to remain open to why things happen. I mean, poverty is a huge part of why terrorists are spawned. It's not the only reason. There have to be a lot of other things in place. But the fact is, it's too easy to dismiss them as monsters. And there is a gothic rhetoric and imagery that is prevalent in media these days that simply inspires uncritical fear. And that's what I don't find useful.
You mentioned, or we mentioned, I guess, before about repressed fantasies and desires. Can you give us an example?
Okay, let's take two examples. We're back to the Frankenstein monster. We've already talked about the alienated nature of the Frankenstein and monster. But let's talk about his converse, the scientist. What the story of Frankenstein really promises in the persona of the scientist is the modern promise of harnessing nature, that in principle one can create a utopia on Earth. This is Francis Bacon's promise. And if you watch the Kenneth Branagh version, you know, which is sort of this extremely romantic version of the same story, then Frankenstein emerges as the modern promise of being able to take over nature completely and thus be able to carry an immortal love through despite death. So there is that fantasy of having love forever. Vampires and serial killers, while we are repelled by their propensity for violence, display a certain glamour as well. They have also a certain genius, I think, that makes a lot of people want to be like them. So those are two concrete examples.
Okay. Now, does the association of monster as applied to criminals, and I mentioned before about sex crimes, etc., does that actually assist law enforcement in any way?
Oh, yes, it helps them, again, create faster policies. I mean, the three strikes you're out is a good example of a gothic criminological policy, precisely because of the language of fear that is rooted in the very policy itself. I mean, these criminals are nothing more than predators. We don't even need to understand them. They just have to be captured and held in prison with no parole. So it's certainly it helps make policies be affected much faster.
I would imagine that since you teach law, that you teach a course on monsters. Am I correct?
Well, most of my courses deal with human rights, actually. So, yes, images of monstrosity are part of the rhetoric, but more importantly, the cultural and legal landscape that produced them is the more important thing for me.
Should it be a course included for people that are studying law or criminology?
I believe so. Actually, I had a course on Gothic criminology, which I co-taught with a criminologist here at Florida State University, and we had a broad interdisciplinary audience for it. Unfortunately, because it required special funding, you know, you have two faculty members teaching it at various times, so it could not be continued through. But certainly, there, I think it should be part of the training.
I do, too. How does the movies' use of monsters by the news media possibly distort the public's notion about history?
Well, much of that, again, is because entertainment is an easy way to lull your audience into uncritical acceptance of the stories that are embedded in these apparently factual texts. So, for example, if you take Schindler's List, right, it is based in fact. There was such a man as Schindler, Oscar Schindler, and yes, he did save Jews. The problem is that there are additions into the film itself. Now, take note, of course, Thomas Keneally's novel never set itself up as an absolute historical fact. It was a novelized rendition of historical fact, and it was unabashed about saying that. Schindler's List, on the other hand, was packaged and commercialized as an absolute historical document. The problem is, if you do know some of the historical facts, there are things that disturb one a little bit. For example, the Schindler women who are led into the shower room are shown in such a way that the descent into the shower room is done through the eyes of a voyeur, right? Someone who's sort of a peeping Tom, if you wish. And that kind of, because there's a peephole and the camera moves into that, and you move through the peephole to look at them huddled together in their nakedness, shivering. And you think for a minute, oh my gosh, he's not going to do it, is he? He's going to show people being gassed to death. And it's not an accident that it's women who are naked and beautiful who are being shown as, you know, eroticized objects of this rather sadistic gaze. And then, of course, he withholds that promise, and it becomes a reverse Psycho, because Psycho begins with the promise of possible rejuvenation, a new life for Marion, because she's washing away her sins as she enjoys the pleasures of the shower. But it doesn't happen. She gets killed off. In this one, you're expecting them to be killed off, but it reverses. The gas chamber, potential gas chamber, turns out to be a real shower, and they enjoy the pleasures of the shower. So there are a few things about the media that are disturbing, and they have to do with the appropriation of horror techniques in order to enhance the entertainment value of the film. The second example, of course, is the basement scene where Helena, the maid, is assaulted by Gert, the main Nazi officer, and the way the camera revolves around her is very much like Silence of the Lambs, when you're taking the look of the serial killer as he circles predatorily his potential victim. And that kind of camera work is used to set up that story.
Sure. Kate, got to take another break. We'll be right back. You're okay. Listening to Global Issues, your host, Vic Plessner.
We'll be right back with your host, Vic Plessner, and his guest, Kay Picard. If you want a chance to win a copy of Kay Picard's book, Remaking the Frankenstein Myth on Film, Between Laughter and Horror, go to radiobangkok.net/GI for Global Issues. Complete the 5 checkoff questions, and we'll enter your name into the hat and select a winner. That's radiobangkok.net/GI. We hope you are enjoying this show of Global Issues with your host, Vic Plessner. If you would like to be a sponsor or guest of Global Issues, please contact us at globalissues.radiobangkok.net. That's globalissues.radiobangkok.net. Hot in the city.
Welcome back, Kay. Where can people buy your books and find out more about you? Do you have a website, and is there a bookstore they should go to?
The easiest way, actually, is just to go to Amazon or to Google my name. And my full name is Caroline Joan S. Picard. I actually don't go by K much, except through my art. So the easiest way, I repeat, is through Amazon, Google, and they carry all of my books. The other way is to go to my specialized website and www.kinestheticsportisart.com will link you up with the more specialized academic sites like the English site here at Florida State University. If you wish me to read out that particular URL, it is english.fsu.edu/faculty/ just the letter K, and then PICART.htm. And then I have another website that shows the whole spectrum, including the dancing and the art, but I think we'll hold that one.
Okay. And also, if any of our listeners didn't get that and they want the information, just email me at victor@vhpconsult.com, and we'll make sure that you get that information. Kay, I'm not even qualified to ask this question. I have two left feet. I understand that you compete in dancing. What style of dancing do you do? And tell us a little bit about some of the competitions that you've been in.
Are you sure you don't have two right feet? I'm teasing. Anyway.
Very good. I like that.
In any case, the style of dancing I do is cabaret. It's a mix of ballroom, ballet, and gymnastics. Visually, it looks a lot like ice dancing, ice pairs dancing. Without the skates, of course, and the ice, but that's the closest analogy I can think of. And, of course, the most recent competitions you've mentioned, the Millennium Dance Sport Nationals, which is the Nationals for Cabaret, in June 2005, where I placed second in the Pro-Am division.
Wow.
With Tony Prado, thank you. And we had actually just started working this year in late January. And then the U.S. Worlds, again, the Pro-Am category, Cabaret, with Eric Luna, a different partner. So we had 26 hours to get in shape, and that was in September 2005.
Yikes. And typically, like now, do you practice now for the next event that's coming up?
Yes, we're gearing up. Now, of course, depending on how much money and how much time you have, you know, you could compete every month if you wanted to. In fact, every week if you wanted to. But I have other lives, and so I tend to gear up for the bigger events. So, yes, we're restarting work. It typically takes people, I would say, 6 months to get in shape, and I've been pushing it a little bit because every time I've partnered with somebody, it's been, with Tony, it was about, you know, 2.5 months, and I kept flying every weekend to see him. With Eric Luna, it was 26 hours total, done in about 2 weeks, you know.
Do you still broadcast ballroom dancing with a twist on the Internet?
Yes, although we're revising the format a little bit because I wanted the most contemporary music to be featured on the show. They were using the more classical formats, which is great too, but I wanted to reach out to a younger audience as well. So I suggested that we hold the show a little bit until the latest music comes in.
Now tell me what is a visual artist, because I know you're a visual artist and I'm not familiar with that term.
Well, I guess I use mixed media. Typically, I have a pencil or ink base to set out the outlines of the piece, and then on top of that, I do a wash using oil pastels to give it a general atmosphere, for lack of words. And then on top of that, I either do more oil pastels and then finish it off probably with colored pencils for the clarity of line, because I like the richness of the oil pastels, the translucence of them if you make them into washes, but I also like the fineness and definition of colored pencils. So I'm trying to get the best of all the media.
The pictures that I saw on your website, are those all that you have done?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that. And your business is called Kinesthetics?
Yes.
And again, how can people find out about that or buy some of your work, because it's really beautiful.
Thank you very much. It's called the website is called www.kinestheticsportasart, so that's one word, .com. And the root words actually are, kinesthetics comes from two words, kinetics, which means motion, and aesthetics, which means the study of art and beauty, of course. And the whole idea of the business when it first started really was that because I was doing a lot of dance competitions, and there were a lot of people who saw my art who came up to me and said, well, can you do something based on a snapshot, you know? So I said, okay, sure, why don't we start with you giving me several poses, and then I can see what I can compose. And that really is what started the business. So the whole idea of motion being captured through a snapshot turned into a work of art. That's what started it. But it's blossomed much more than that now.
Now, I'm going to get you in trouble now with the university. If you had
oh, dear.
If you had to stop everything and you could only do one thing that you
yes,
do
what
now,
would that be?
What would that be?
Actually, I'll be honest, I can't imagine that. I need to do everything I do at the moment because they complete various parts of my personality, so I'm afraid I'll have to give you the bad answer and say, sorry, refuse the scenario, I can't do that.
That's quite all right. That's a good answer. And you just led me to another question then. Does everything kind of interweave in
yes.
what you're doing?
Yes. So when I dance, it somehow gets transmuted into a work of art, and later down the line it becomes captured in one of my books. So, yes, I'm afraid I can't shut off. They just tend to roll into each other or weave seamlessly into each other.
Sure. What's your next book or project that we should look out for?
There are two. One has already been accepted and should be forthcoming or coming out this year with Southern Illinois University Press. The tentative title is Holocaust as Horror, so it's very much about the topic we've been talking about. The second one, which is under review, is another book on ballroom dance. It's called Inside Edge, Creating Ballroom Champions. And that's more autobiographical, autoethnographic, meaning field interviews. It's not as abstract as, well, not really abstract, but more theoretically oriented as my first dance sport book, From Ballroom to Dance Sport, which is about the road to the Olympics, actually. That's another book that just came out literally in December of 2005.
Wow. Kay, our show is coming to an end. This has been a fantastic show. I really loved working with you today, and hopes that we can, you know, do this again sometime.
I'd love to very much, and it's been great fun.
Thanks very much. You're listening to Vic Plessner, Global Issues. Get our show next week.
We hope you enjoyed this show of Global Issues with your host, Victor Plessner. Be sure to listen next week when Vic will have another exciting guest to discuss global issues.